Good evening and welcome to our meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and our program, The State of California's Water, Now and in the Future, with Felicia Marcus, who's chair of the California State Water Resources Control Board. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. This program tonight is co-sponsored by the Business and Leadership member-led forum, Kevin O'Malley Chair. A special welcome to our members and new members. If you have not yet become a member, we urge you to join us. Visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org and look for our Commonwealth Club magazine. Also, look at your chair seat and you will find a green sheet. And this has the announcements of our environment and natural resources programs remaining for the spring. There are two left, and we hope you'll join us for them, June 4th. This is my very favorite title, almost of all of the titles I've seen. It's called, I Never Knew There Were So Many Stars in the Sky. And this is about San Francisco ninth graders who went up to Fort Camp Mather in the Sierras for a week to learn about the environment last year. And they're actually going to have another group go up this year to enjoy the Sierras and the camp and also learn. So the I Never Knew There Were So Many Stars in the Sky really meant a lot to these young people and the young people who are going, because many of them have never been out of San Francisco. Our other program that will actually end our spring series is June 17th, Worldwide Challenges in the Environment, Difficult Necessary Dialogues. And this is Dr. Leslie Wong, who's the president of San Francisco State University. San Francisco State University is hosting the statewide California Higher Education Sustainability Conference from July 24th in San Francisco for public and private universities, colleges, and community colleges. The public is also invited to attend. So if you would like to attend at the conference that's happening in July here in San Francisco, contact San Francisco State University. We hope that you will take advantage of what's coming in the summer and that you all have a really good summer to enjoy. And hopefully not too much fog here in San Francisco. If it rained, that would be wonderful. We hope it rains. We hope it rains every day. Some reminders for tonight. Our program is timed for 1 hour. Please make sure that all cell phones, PDAs, and other noise-making devices are turned off. We will have question cards for the audience to fill out. You will find the cards on your seats, and I will collect them. We will now pause for 1 moment and then begin the program for our radio, television, and internet audiences. This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Co-sponsoring our program tonight is the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum with Kevin O'Malley, Chair. Our program is The State of California's Water, Now and in the Future, with Felicia Marcus, who's Chair of the State Water Resources Control Board. It is a pleasure for me to welcome Felicia to the Commonwealth Club. Highly respected for her work, Felicia brings the latest information about California's water resources and drought conditions. Felicia, we're proud to have you here, and we welcome you.
Thank you, Anne. It's always a pleasure to be at the Commonwealth Club. I can't tell you how nice it is to have people who are interested in California. I know everybody reads the California Water, everyone reads the paper. Not everyone thinks they're an expert, but in my life, many people have expertise on a very narrow slice of it, and few people are really interested in a broader picture. Actually, that's probably not fair. Maybe just in my daily life, since we hear combatants in some of the ongoing water wars. So thank you very much for inviting me, and I look forward to the opportunity not only to sharing some thoughts with you that I hope are helpful, but also in our discussion a little bit later. So I'm going to try and go rather quickly, and I'm going to try and do a number of things in this talk. I'm going to give a sense of the context of California water, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time on that. I'm going to do it not just for my own therapeutic purposes, but also in some ways to arm you for your time in the discourse on California water. What I found working for decades on this issue, first at the local level on water quality, later at the federal level on water supply, and now at the state level on both, as well as time spent in the private sector and the nonprofit sector, is that there's a tremendous amount of detail in what people do. And California water is different in some ways, the discourse, the public policy discourse, than I found in air quality or even in toxics. They all have their unique flavor. And in the world of California water, one of the strange dynamics is you will have people who know something very well and will talk about it and they'll say, this is the one answer, why don't those buffoons do this? And insert for buffoons, not just government players, it could be some of the combatants. And it's been interesting to me, having been in the water world and then taking myself out for nearly a decade and then coming back in, to find that I came back in and there are many people who are saying the exact same things they said a decade before, just louder and slower at each other, and very sincerely felt, too. It's not artifice. And seemingly unaware of the other facets of California water. And so I'm on something of a mission because I've had the opportunity, north-south quality and supply, to arm you with some sense of some of the key issues in California water writ large, on the supply side in particular. Then a drought update. There's much that's been written about. The polls recently have been heartening to me in that over 90% of the public knows we're in a drought. 9 months ago, that was not the case in urban California. It was definitely the case in rural California. So that's good. But people also have a sense that they're already doing a lot, but their neighbor isn't. So they're doing a lot, but nobody else is. And we're at that phase where we're now in the phase of a dynamic where folks are thinking they're good and someone else has to be bad. I don't know why that is. If any of you are psychologists, I would appreciate a tutorial. But we're in that phase a little bit, and in the Q&A, I hope I can illuminate some of that. And then I wanted to give some big picture of where we need to go in the face of climate change in particular. And I will tell you that though I may tell you some things you didn't know that seem discouraging, overall I'm very optimistic because having done this for decades, having left the field, in some ways run screaming out of it to do land conservation where people know how to make a deal and make progress every day, it's been nice to come back and see that things actually have changed. There's the louder and slower, same guys, little grayer, same words, but you also have a whole new set of players, and not just millennials who are much more multi-issue and problem-solving oriented, but you actually have people who have come together to try and solve problems across what were once unbridgeable divides, whether they were geographic divides or just the divides of discipline and profession, where your flood control people, your water supply people, your water treatment people, I used to run a sewage system, your wastewater people, your parks and open space people lived in completely different worlds. You now see them coming together to figure out how to use the same drop of water more intelligently, not just from a water perspective, but from a money perspective. So that you can use the same drop of water to meet multiple needs, but you can also use the same scarce local dollar to meet multiple needs. And I am seeing that happening. So I have to tell you that I am optimistic because I'm going to share some things with you that are a little bit scary. And I'll just tell you that I think we can make it. So it's going to be a slog. There's a lot we have to do. But quite frankly, we are so inefficient in our water use that there's a lot we can do to build resilience in the face of climate change and buy ourselves the time that it will take for technological breakthroughs, which inevitably we will need. And then I'll talk a little bit about the urban conservation regs just because they've got a lot of play and you may be wondering about them. But I'm going to go rather quickly because we're sitting here in San Francisco, which has among the lowest water use and the lowest target, so it may not be as big of an issue for you as it is in other places. Now, don't be afraid of this slide. This is my elephant slide. This is the elephant slide that you can turn into a wallet card to help gird you for knowing when people are just don't know what they're talking about because they're telling you it's just one thing. So I'm going to arm you a little bit. And obviously, this is much bigger. We don't have a lot of time, but I at least want to share with you some defining characteristics about California water that are pretty basic but which get lost in the day-to-day discourse and certainly in the media coverage. And there are whole reasons for that. Nothing bad about the media, but where we once had full-time environmental and other resource reporters, we now have fewer of them, and they have to cover five or six stories a day. And there are, a lot of them are terribly nice, and I like them a lot, but it's hard for them to write in-depth stories, which I know those of you who would come to the Commonwealth Club would actually like to read. So number one, we actually do have the most variable hydrology in the country. What does that mean? That means it doesn't rain uniformly every year. Sometimes it rains a lot, sometimes it rains a little, sometimes in between. We can't predict it, but we have wider swings than anywhere else in the country, even than anywhere else in the West. Now, the West is prone to this, and that's why, this is another thing most people don't realize, that's why we have a water rights system that's based on the seniority system. You may have heard a little bit about this. It's first in time, first in right, developed in some ways, you know, it builds on other things, but it is developed in a way where you have first riparian rights, which are the folks who have a right to sort of the reasonable use of water off a water course. You've got appropriative rights, which were based in some part on miners' rules. So you could claim water to take somewhere else. You had to claim it publicly, which could be tacking a note on a tree. And it's not just amount. It's time, place, and method of diversion. And those are all in line to the minute. You had to file it in the county clerk at some point. And then you have what are so-called junior water rights, which are the post-1914 are junior, and that's when we created the formal water rights system in California. Those people have to get permits, and they can true them up to license. And they have to report every year. Seniors now have to report every 3 years to the water board. And my board, the water board, is a combination of prior things that do, we have a water rights, but I'm like a water rights judge in that wearing that hat. Other states have water rights judges. Water quality, which is the water quality rules you hear about from time to time. We now have the drinking water program as of last year. The legislature gave it to us. So you'd have one entity responsible for water from source to tap, both as a way to sharpen the mind and try and protect drinking water, for, particularly for vulnerable communities, and also to help with recycling. So we didn't have multiple agencies trying to do meetings to try just to streamline things, not sacrifice public health or sacrifice the environment, but just be more efficient. And then we have the Division of Financial Assistance, which gives lots of money in loans and grants to deal with water quality and drinking water issues, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So it varies from year to year. It varies from place to place. Most of the population in California does not live where the water falls, and we have a massive system of infrastructure that's been built over the last 100 years that I'll show you briefly that is a marvel of social and economic and food development envied across the world. It's had some environmental impacts because a lot of it was built before we had the sensibilities we have today about the importance of maintaining fish and wildlife, and we do a number of things to course correct for that at my board. I'm not going to talk about it at great length, but it ends up being very challenging. And also the water doesn't fall at the time of year when most of it's used. Basic stuff. Second, every area has a totally different mix of sources. And frankly, in urban California, most people have no clue where their water comes from. Some places in this state, definitely not the majority of people in this state in this day and age, know where their water comes from. They see that river and they know that's where their water comes from. That's not true in most of California. There are some areas like San Francisco that has the Hetch Hetchy system, or East Bay Mud, which has the McCollum system, or L.A., which has the Owens Valley system made famous through Chinatown, that went and developed their own source of water up in the Sierras or in the Eastern Sierras and spent the money to bring it down through a complex system of conveyances, and yours is being upgraded as we speak massive public works project. Other people get their water from the state and federal projects, and you see that in the news a lot. Those are two big systems that were built in the middle of the last century to put more dams and storage up in the Sierras and bring that water down, and that's in great part what helped Southern California and Central Valley blooming over the course of the last 60 or so years. I guess more than that, I won't do the math. And then every place has a different mix of groundwater. That water underfoot that got in the news a fair amount this last year is we finally, after 100 years, got groundwater management legislation passed in the state of California, and we caught up with the rest of the union on that one, finally, last year. But that one varies very intensively from place to place. It could vary from here to Union Square, because it's so varied underground. Some areas are lucky enough to have all three of those. Other areas don't have more than one of those. And so as a result, depending on where you are, you may see California water in a completely different way. And also as a result, the impact of the drought varies greatly, in part also because of that mix of water rights I told you about. So if you go through the Central Valley or other parts of the state, you may see a field that's perfectly lush and blooming, and right next to it is a fallowed field. And that is a function of senior to junior water rights or contract rights. So it is very, very complicated. It also is going to mean that the solutions are going to vary for different places. And I'll jump to that and then jump back. In the urban context, conservation is the cheapest, fastest, and smartest way to extend our water resources. We use it incredibly wastefully. We're not bad. We've just had the luxury of doing that. About 50% on average is used outdoors on ornamental landscaping. Maybe less than 50 is ornamental. There's functional landscaping, like if you play ball with a kid in the backyard or you have trees. Trees are very important. But a lot of, particularly a lot of turf that people routinely overwater because they don't realize how little a lawn really needs to survive. People do tend to water the 3 feet under their lawn, generally without knowing it. More is better, right? Maybe not. Recycling is on the rise. In Southern California, we have some of the largest projects in the nation, Orange County in particular, which is using recycled water, adding it to stormwater capture, and recharging their groundwater basin. They're the largest such project in the country, but a lot of other areas are also doing that. And stormwater capture increasingly is becoming the norm and part of the fabric of the future for Southern California cities, and in some cases some cities here, where, again, that flood control system was built to get water and whisk it out to the ocean or the bay as quickly as possible, for good reason, for public safety and the like, and property protection. But people have turned their eyes to it and realized there's a resource we should be capturing and filtering in the ground or putting into reservoirs. And then there's desal, which many people point to, particularly in the Central Valley. They wonder why we're not making all of our coastal population go to desal. But it's the most expensive water out there right now, very energy intensive, and it does have some impact on the marine environment. We just set the first in the world, apparently, environmental standards just last week for desal, and we did it to lay a foundation and the rules of the road so that communities could prepare to do this, but that there would be a level playing field, it would deal with its externalities, and we'd be able to protect the marine environment as certain communities opt to spend that extra money because they don't have as many other options. So, for example, in San Diego, they're building the largest desalination facility in the world. It'll be done this fall. It's going to be very expensive water. It will meet, even though it's the biggest, not in the world, in the country, even though it's the biggest one in our country, it'll meet just 7% of their needs. But to them, they don't have groundwater basins to manage like folks in L.A. do and folks in many areas or folks in the San Gabriel Valley. So they could try and do stormwater capture or recycling, but they don't have any place to put it. Interesting. They're also the most aggressive on pushing us to do our next set of regulations on recycled water, which will allow for indirect potable reuse surface water augmentation, because then they could pipe it up to their reservoir where it would mix with other surface water but then be totally retreated before it went into the drinking water. Again, very expensive water, but they don't have the luxury of having groundwater, and they are at the end of multiple pipes. And then again, what does it also mean? It means that storage, which is one of those issues in California water, which frequently has a level of discourse that's a little bit like an Emily Letella routine or an Abbott and Costello routine of is so, is not, you're jerk, no, I'm not. It actually brings it pretty much to the fore because of this variable hydrology, we really need a place to put water. We need a place to put water that's captured in the surface. We also need a place to put recycled water and stormwater, and that means we have to look at our groundwater basins. We have to deal with groundwater management so that we can use it for storage, and we do need to actually talk about surface storage, big and small, in different places. Need to deal with its environmental impacts and externalities just as desal, but we have to be open to it. And here's why. Population growth is going to happen. Climate change is going to happen. And the predictions on climate change are chilling. Well, they're actually not. They're warming. But I just thought of that. The predictions are it's going to get warmer. That's one thing we know, by even a few degrees. And that means that more precipitation, we may get the same amount of precipitation, but it's more likely to fall as rain rather than snow. And what impact does that have? That means we'll have flooding, so we've got to deal with preparing for flooding and figuring out how to capture some of that water for later use. But it also means, well, a lot of that water for later use, also means we're going to lose our snowpack, just like this year, which, remember, last year was unusually hot. I'm glad it's cold, or people are saying it's cold in May, because cold is better. But it was so warm that we didn't have much snowpack. And snowpack on an average year, not that there's really an average year, but in an average year, snowpack accounts for a third of the storage we need because of that variable hydrology. So even though some people will say, and rightly so, that some of our reservoirs at the beginning of this year had a little more water than they did last year, we're still in worse shape. Because there are other reservoirs, particularly along the San Joaquin, that have less water, but more importantly, we don't have any snowpack. So we've got a lot less water because it melts out in the spring and summer and refills the reservoirs and replenishes surface water. So snowpack is very important. We're going to lose it. We've got to prepare for it. Is that tomorrow? No, it's this year in a drought. But we know in a few decades it's going to become the norm. So there's no time like the present to start thinking differently and start being open to storage. And that drove the administration pushing so hard to get over the 100-year block about groundwater management, because our groundwater basins are the only thing that can approximate our snowpack in size. And it can. It can. But it's not been managed in many parts of the state. Southern California is very well managed. It's called adjudication. It's adjudicated. There are judges looking over it. Their Santa Clara Valley Water District is one of the models. You've got some counties, Butte County, Yuba County, that have done a nice job. But the rest of the state needs to catch up, and they're going to need to catch up so they can use it for storage. There's no way we would ever build enough surface reservoirs to come even close to that size. It doesn't mean we don't need some in some places. They got to pay their way, and people have got to put up cost share, and they've got to share it with public benefits for fish and others. But we've got to get over the is-so, is-not on this one and talk about the how, where, and why. Then the drought. And again, I'm going to flash through the other slides very, very quickly. The drought. This is, no matter how you look at it, the worst in impact in modern history. It's the drought of our time, the drought of our lives, the drought of our grandparents' lives, it would be. But it's not the worst in history. We have evidence in nature, tree rings and the like, that we've had 400-year droughts around the time of Henry VIII. For those of you who are history buffs, I don't think he was that concerned about what was happening in California. I don't know if he even knew about California. We were dragons. We were where the dragons were. We've had it before. We also know it's not unknown in our time in other places. The Australians went through what they call the millennial drought in the 2000s. What they tell us is they thought they were in the typical 3-year drought cycle that we've been in, more or less, for the past 100 or so years. They kept thinking for about 6 years that it would just rain, that El Nino, or for them it's something else, would save them. And they put it off, and they put it off, and they put it off. And then it rained a little bit the end of year 6, and they thought, great, just like the rest of us thought, great, in December when it was raining. I mean, you heard me, if you were watching the news, saying it ain't over till it's over, but even I was saying, oh, please let it be over, but it wasn't. And so at the end of year 6, they thought, okay, it's over, and then they had the 3 worst years yet, and they had to go pedal to the metal and spend billions of dollars that they wished they didn't have to spend, and they built a fleet of desal facilities because they couldn't risk their major cities running out of water, most of which have not been operated. Because by the time they were done constructing it, of course it did rain. But they still are paying for those plants heavily, even though they're not operating them. And the reason they're not operating them is that it's cheaper to deal with the conservation, recycling, and stormwater capture that they also went pedal to the metal on. They just didn't know when it was going to rain, and so they did everything all at once. So we want to make sure that that doesn't happen to us, because our last bad drought was in 77 that was anywhere near as bad as this, but since 77 we have millions more people. We've got way more, twice as much irrigated agricultural production dependent on the same drop of water, precisely because agriculture has become so much more efficient. They've just put that efficiency into growing more food and fiber, which, depending on how you look at it, is an incredible economic and food miracle. But they get hurt, proportionally. And we also have more endangered and threatened species that can't weather a drought the way they used to, both because they're not resilient enough because they're so endangered and threatened and they don't have the population numbers, or because we've altered their habitat so much that they don't have the cold water refugia they used to just hang out in for a while. And this year, definitely not looking good.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the State of California's Water Now and in the Future, with Felicia Marcus, Chair of California State Water Resources Control Board.
Thank you. Now I'm just going to flip through the rest of the slides rather quickly and stop on some of these points. There's our variability. I don't know. Do you see these blue dots? Can't you see that we're more variable? That's what that means. Sorry. Actually, it's funny. I was on a webinar with a bunch of water law judges from the other states, and they kind of laugh when I'm on because we are so much less robust in our measurement and monitoring and systems than the other western states when it comes to the water supply side. We're way ahead on water quality. I mean, they have everything metered and managed, and they know where things are, and they've adjudicated most of their major systems, and we have not. But when I got to that slide, the question was, why would you be different? And I just said, well, it probably has something to do with that coast and those mountains. I'm not entirely sure, but I'm guessing that's what it is. Here just shows you, just taking a Sac Valley snapshot, that variability, just so you can see it visually, how different the years can be. Again, seasonal mismatch. And this is one I always like to show folks in Southern California. There's the water. There are the people. You have a lot of people, too, but be situationally aware here. And these are the water projects I talked about. The green ones are those individually done. The Colorado River is a federally run system, which, to our great luck, the Imperial Irrigation District is the most senior water user on it. That's why 90% of the nation's salad comes from the Imperial Valley in the winter, probably 50% the rest of the time. The orange and the purple are the state and federal water projects. It's even more complicated than that. And the UR here would be San Francisco or the East Bay Mud Line. And I do like to point out that this is my tweak for you, that the Bay Area is just as dependent on Delta water as Southern California is. It's just you take it above the Delta so you're not hostage to the pumps. Sorry, there's equal opportunity here. There's the Delta, and this could be a whole talk. I'm just going to flag it because it is such a big issue in California. You know, the Sacramento River comes south. The San Joaquin River goes north. It goes through this web of islands, and there are giant pumps at the bottom near that pool you see, Clifton Court Forebay, which are giant, massive pumps. And when they're on, they are so strong that they create a reverse flow of those rivers. That has tremendous impacts on salmon in particular, also on smelt. I know more about salmon than smelt. Makes it hard for the migrating little guys to get out in the spring. It makes it hard for the more mature ones to come back 3 years later and smell their way home in that miracle of nature that is salmon's life cycle and spawning. It also just messes them up. They get tired in there. They're sitting ducks for predators, and it wreaks havoc with them. It also is something where if you look at the dependence of folks on the Delta in Central Valley and Southern California, this is a tidal estuary. And the state and federal projects, one of their big purposes was to store water they can then release to repel salinity so that the water is fit for human consumption and ag both inside the Delta and for export. I mean, it's a massive engineering marvel. Again, it's had fish impacts, and we're trying to course correct on that, but actually rather remarkable and fragile Delta levees. If you don't know the Delta, I suggest you go visit it. It's a marvelous, marvelous place worthy of protection there as well. That's what it once looked like, a meandering tidal stream where the smolts could hide from predators, and we didn't have as many predators. Those of you who fish for bass, they are salmon killers galore. In any event, that's when the fish wars, fish versus fish, is a whole other story. And that's what it looks like now. It's folk, they get confused. They wander off. They're not staying in the main stem. And then there's the dependence on the Delta, very important. And when you hear the story of the about the tunnels project, the Delta, I think it's called the Water Fix now. It just changed. And then the ecological restoration, this is the area that they're talking about. And what they're talking about is adding an additional, remember I said it was flow, time, place, and manner of diversion, an additional diversion. So when the fish are at the bottom, you could pump from the top. If the Delta collapsed from an earthquake or storm or other levee collapse, you could pump from the top. When the fish are near the top, you could pump from the bottom. More flexibility in the system, but the big fight is over how much water, and my board will decide that off into the future. And it is something very legitimately, the folks who live in the Delta are worried that if Southern California and the Central Valley are not dependent on taking water from the bottom of the Delta, that everyone will forget about their water quality. And it is a legitimate fear and something that we need to deal with in any sort of fix. I already talked about this. I add food security to the list because, again, if you're thinking a few decades out, California is one of only five Mediterranean climates in the world that can grow the level of healthy fruits and vegetables and, yes, nuts that we grow. And that's going to become more important in the world, in the nation, et cetera. We grow the healthy stuff that Dr. Oz and Michelle Obama want us to eat. And that we want to eat. And so it's something to be valued, not taken for granted. It doesn't mean ag can't be more efficient. Certainly it can. And it, as you can imagine, it varies greatly. But it's something we shouldn't take for granted and point fingers at. It's a valuable thing that agriculture does, and we depend on it. Urban people eat food. Our water footprint is probably bigger from the food we eat from the Central Valley than it is on our lawns. And yet we'll point to the Central Valley as if they're bad, which drive them crazy, which is just a sense of, our water doesn't just come out of the tap. Again, a miracle of modern civilization that folks in urban California can take their water for granted. It comes out the tap and it's safe and clean. That's an astonishing accomplishment, but it creates a problem in a time of drought where people don't even know where it comes from. The same, our food doesn't come from the supermarket, but there are people who think that's where it comes from. Again, a miracle of modern civilization. Folks in the Central Valley and rural communities don't take either for granted. But in urban California, which is most of the population of California, we can. There's an upside. There's a downside. And I won't talk about getting over ourselves because that can take a long time. Here we go. Ben Franklin, my favorite. Beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. You may think I have that up there because no water, no beer, right? But that's not it. Sorry. I just like that quote. Here's the one I was looking for. This is when you're working late at night doing your PowerPoint slides. When the well is dry, we know the worth of water. I talked about this, how bad the drought is. I think I talked about all of this. Remember Australia and climate change. That's our future look, but we can retrofit ourselves. Oh, that didn't work. Sorry. That was just showing it was nothing to have a party over. It goes way up there when it shows. There's our snowpack. That's what it looked like year to year, 13 to 14. It looks pretty much the same today. That is very dismal, and that is our life in a climate change future. Frightening when you think of it as a third of our storage. That's for people who like graphs or want to remember what snow looks like. And there you go. This is a little out of date. It's worse now. And then here are the impacts, which I wanted to talk about a little bit. There was a lot of media on April 1st when the governor did his fourth executive order and directed us to do urban conservation regs, and people said he exempted ag. Well, I'm sorry, he did a bunch of earlier executive orders that actually gave us the authority to more effectively curtail agricultural use, which we did all last year. Ag and rural California has borne the brunt of this drought big time. We've got over 400,000 acres fallowed. Over 17,000 people out of work. These are UC Davis numbers. A diminished yield on others because of substitution or less water, groundwater substitution. Our groundwater levels are dropping, but thank God we have them. UC Davis estimates the impact would be 10 times as bad. Imagine that. Do the math. If folks didn't have groundwater to use, part of the reason to have groundwater management is so it's there when you need it in a drought. So the groundwater legislation wasn't about this drought. It was about preparing for future droughts. Fish and wildlife have been horribly impacted, and wildfires. We've done a lot. I won't go through this. A lot of money has gone out for delivering over 500,000 food boxes to poor communities, particularly in the Tulare Basin. We're delivering water in bottles and tankers. People are bathing out of buckets and going to community centers to shower in parts of California. That's why, forgive me, I'm a little less sensitive to people who feel oppressed for, because we're suggesting, not requiring, but suggesting that they don't have emerald green lawns all of the time. Again, understandable if you don't know, but the fact of the matter is there are people hurting, and this year they're going to hurt a lot more. The estimates are closer to 1 million acres out of production and more people out of work. Just so you know, the federal and state teams have worked together very, very well. That doesn't always happen. We've made adjustments to water rights permits to try and protect that water in storage. We've cut fish flows. We've cut exports and all that to save water to maintain salinity control in the Delta primarily. We've implemented water rights and cut off juniors. We just did it again last week. We cut off all the juniors in the Bay Delta system, and we're going to go further up the senior water rights chain than ever before. And we've been adding supply through integrated water management money, but also recycled water financing and streamlining of permits, because that's the cheapest, fastest, smartest thing after conservation, and we're going to keep going. And then we have the water conservation regulations that we've been doing for quite a while. And I'll talk about that just a little bit, and then a lot of fish and wildlife. Here, you heard about the 25% statewide reduction. That's not 25% for everybody. That's 25% that's scaled, because some people use a lot less water than others. Folks who are in the lower tier have an 8% goal. And San Francisco, bless its heart, at 45 gallons per capita per day, under the public health standard just for indoors, said, no problem, we can do it, we'll do it. It was great. And meanwhile, you have people using 300, 400, and 500 gallons per capita per day who are screaming bloody murder at us because we're asking them to do 36. But, again, they're still going to be way higher, but they haven't done it yet. They haven't gotten over that hurdle of actually going to their customers and asking them to conserve. So it's a sliding scale between 8 and 36%. And there were additional prohibitions you may have heard about I won't go into. We're helping agencies with rates and pricing. A website's going to go up to help them because they are going to have a hard time explaining to their consumers as they try to change their rates, because the rates will go up as you use less water. You won't necessarily pay more than you would have, but it's hard to explain to people that it's a service to run a water system, and many of them haven't made the changes that others have, and they've been selling it like a commodity, which it isn't. It's a service. It costs more to bring in that extra increment. But with a recent case in the San Juan Capistrano case, they're going to have to work a lot harder on that to justify it, and that's all to the good. Conservation incentive programs you'll hear about tomorrow in the governor's May revise. He did carrots as well as sticks, and we're going to add money into the turf rebate and the appliance rebate programs that you'll hear about those. And there were some other things they did. I've talked about these. There's more detail than you need. Again, remember Australia. I have a picture like this on my bathroom mirror. Remember the Australians. And Sao Paulo, they just turned the water off because they didn't want to inconvenience their customers in an election cycle. So it wasn't until after their last elections that they told people they were running out of water, and they're down to 8% or less now in a major metropolitan area of 13 million. And they just have to turn the water off. It's like a third world response. So we're planning for the worst. Okay, I did that. This just is a set of numbers to show you the Australians use a lot less, and if you go to Australia, won't really look like it. They've kept their number down even though it rained. The big difference, outdoor, huge difference in how much water we use versus what they use. Toilets, they've retrofit them all. Southern California is largely retrofit. Northern California is not. Faucets, leaks. Leaks are big, too. We haven't pushed leaks, even though that's a good place to go, because it costs a lot of money, and we're trying to do the things that are least expensive first. We're planning for year 5 and 6, and then we have some long-term planning, too, that I want to tell you about. Do you want to?
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the state of California's water now and in its future, with Felicia Marcus, Chair of California State Water Resources Control Board. And we're about at that point. We're going to ask some audience questions. But first, you tell us about Abraham Lincoln that we're looking at?
Well, I'm going to wrap up a little bit and go quickly here just to give you some sense of hope for the future. I found this. Obviously, I was not just looking for beer quotes, but I found one anyway. I was looking for something about dealing with reality because the times call upon us to let go of our rhetoric and deal with reality. And he said, I'm a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. The great point is to bring them the real facts and beer. And I thought, what's the deal with this beer stuff and our national leaders? So, you know, up late at night Googling, and I looked up Ronald Reagan, John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and Bobby Kennedy, and beer, each individually. And I got nothing. I was a little disappointed. But I did get this from Martin Luther, the original. Whoever drinks beer, he is quick to sleep long. Does not sin. Whoever does not sin enters heaven. Thus, let us drink beer. Just saying. Go figure. Here's the reality I told you about, loss of snowpack. Here's the reality, sea level rise, which definitely threatens the Delta, not necessarily in a linear way, but we have to deal with that reality versus the rhetoric that people toss back and forth. We have millions of people in California that don't drink safe water. If you're in an urban area, you have the money to treat, blend, or deal with it. If you're in rural California, you do not. And that's probably our top priority as an administration. I'm just saying. Reality, population's going to grow. Reality, groundwater management hasn't been there. But also reality, we can do something about it through integrated water management, particularly in the urban area, through taking care of our urban watersheds. They can capture and retain more snow and water, which can substitute for the loss of snowpack. So there's stuff we can do. It'll take time. And the reality is we are doing a lot about it. The integrated water management movement has been great. You have all kinds of people reaching across silos. We've had all kinds of drought angels, I call them, farmers who have done things to help fish. It doesn't make the headlines. The rice farmers in the Sag Valley have been particularly good that way. And the legislature, quite differently from where I left it, has been doing a lot. After decades of inaction and just default into rhetorical excess, human right to water, the first in the nation passed the last couple of years. The 2009 Delta Reform Act, a coalition of the willing, people came together that I was proud to be able to work on with some of you in this room, groundwater legislation. And because we had a plan, we actually got that bond passed. So we have billions of dollars to try and do some of those things I talked about. We have a water action plan. I'm not going to go through it. I'm just going to say it is an all-of-the-above strategy that we did over a year ago. If you Google California Water Action Plan, it's very readable and short, and it says we got to do it all. We got to get over ourselves. It doesn't say that, but that's what it means. And we've got to do it all, and we've got to look for multiple benefits and flexibility and figure out how to get this done. We don't have time to just pick one. We've got to do it all. Want bond pass. Those are our priorities. L.A. has made tremendous changes, and that's how we get there. All of the above, we're all in this together. Where do we find convergence over conflict? How do we deal with reality versus rhetoric? And we can make it there. The elephant's on the march. So now let's go to questions.
Thank you, Felicia. That was wonderful. We really enjoyed it. We really enjoyed being informed about all that's happening. This is Ann Clark in the Commonwealth Club, and we've come to our question cards. The first one is, you mentioned technology solutions. Where do you see opportunity for the private sector to develop technology solutions to groundwater storage concerns?
Oh, thank you. And groundwater storage, that's interesting. I've seen a number of things there. I think there's a lot of room for technological innovation, and one of the things that was in the governor's April 1st executive order was the announcement of a water technology initiative. The Energy Commission will be leading that because they have a lot of experience doing that sort of thing, and that'll be coming out in the next couple of months. So there's a home for gathering these good ideas and bringing innovators together. I think the innovations fall into a number of categories. A big part of it is information. We just don't have the information that other Western states have. We know enough to manage this system at a gross level, and I don't mean just managing the water rights system and implementing. I also mean managing the environmental, public health, and other aspects of water. A lot of it is at a gross level, that's okay, but it's not at the precision level. We need to really make intelligent choices and trade-offs in an increasingly complex and expensive world. So all kinds of information technology. You see that in agriculture when you go out there. I mean, it's not everywhere because not everyone can afford it, but in a lot of agricultural communities, you see moisture probes and sensors in the ground. You see farmers farming by iPad. They're using micro spray and drip, and they're putting just the right amount of chemicals on the right part of the field to get the best yield. They're doing petal leaf analysis to figure out what the plant needs, and they're saving inputs of water, chemicals, and fertilizer. It's really pretty impressive. On groundwater, there's a lot we don't know. So there's both a below ground and above ground work that's going. There's been a lot of play for some of NASA JPL's remote sensing where they actually can get a sense of how much water there is. It's fascinating. One of the key spokespeople for that is on our regional board in the Santa Ana region. His name is Jay Famigliati. He's great. So they can sort of see, again, at a gross level at least, how much water is there and how much it's being depleted. That's very important. But there's also technologies that are helping people figure out how to analyze how much water is below ground without having to punch 8 zillion holes everywhere. You still have to punch a lot of holes, but they're using sonar. I saw some technology for sonar, so you can get a quick hit on where existing wells, at least, where their water levels are likely to be. And that's very helpful. I also think anything that helps us analyze in real time what's going on and measure what people are using is going to be very important in the groundwater management arena for local agencies as they come together so they can get the real data they need to do real management. And part of that is going to be making the hard choices about demand reduction so they can actually refill their aquifers and see what areas in that basin are the best for recharge. There are some farmers doing experiments where they're essentially farming water molecules. So they're saying, I'm over a place, or someone's saying, this is a place where we can get the fastest recharge. So Joe, this year you're not planting your crop. We're all going to flood irrigate into yours and let it sink into the ground to replenish the groundwater basin. So you're going to end up with much more sophisticated management there. There are other things. When you get to desal, for example, lower energy desal is going to be important, less impact on the marine environment. Desal, cheaper desal, better membranes and filters and UV to deal with water recycling, to deal with our public health concerns. There's going to be all kinds of things. Even the technology to figure out how to get pipes under the ground without having to dig up every street in Tarnation to do it is going to be helpful. So there's a lot of opportunity.
The wine industry has pioneered some interesting technology, and that is what you're talking a bit about now, and that is being able to measure the water that's available, the water that's in the ground, in the plant, how much water is expected, and seem to have some very sophisticated technology doing that. Has that spread into other areas of agriculture, and what do you see happening there?
It has spread in everywhere someone can afford it. So in many ways, in the almond and other nut crops, you see the same sort of efficiencies because people can afford the technology. But frankly, I've seen it on peach trees. I've seen it in other agricultural arenas where people can afford it. And so really figuring out how to get better penetration of those kinds of technologies is just going to be more efficient from a water quality standpoint. As we roll out, I didn't get to spend time on that slide, our irrigated lands regulatory program, which is dealing with nitrate and pesticide contamination of surface water and groundwater, it all relies on more precise measurements. So there's definitely a market there, but there's also an opportunity to figure out how to get more funding to farmers so that they can employ that. There is a flip side, though, of course, because one farmer's flood runoff is another farmer's supply, and one farmer's flood irrigation can be groundwater recharge. So it's a lot more complicated.
This is an interesting question. It's somewhat of a downer to think about, but I'm going to share it with you. Has anyone calculated when in California water would run out if the drought continues at its present rate?
It's interesting. There were some, unfortunately, I think he was chagrined. Jay, who I talked about, said that we were going to run out of water in a year in a statement. He was trying to get folks' attention. That would be if it didn't rain at all. Our reservoirs would be emptied, and at Deadpool, we are worried about that, but we wouldn't be out of water yet. And again, that varies by where you are, there are groundwater basins all over the state that actually still have water in them. One of our big initiatives, something that has money in the bond for it, is cleaning up contaminated groundwater more rapidly and reusing it than we have in the past. L.A. just discovered the groundwater basin under their feet. It is a Superfund site. But the one in the San Gabriel Valley refills every year. Just the nature, it's gravel. It just goes straight through. Solvents also went straight through, so it's also a Superfund site that I've worked on. But treating water is not rocket science. It is the application of energy and money. And in a dense urban environment, there is the money to do that. It may cost a little bit more, but we can do it. So I don't think we're going to run out of – if it stopped raining and never rained again, we would run out of water. But that's not what's going to happen. We'll get some precipitation. We just won't refill enough to be able to have business as usual. And I think it's agriculture that bears the brunt of it, because I do think urban areas can do a lot more conservation, stormwater capture, recycling to make themselves more resilient, and they can afford to do desal. And so ultimately we won't run out of water. We'll just start using it more efficiently and reusing it over and over again, just as those in the Middle East who have even less water than we do routinely use recycling and desalination to meet their needs. And so in urban California, particularly coastal urban California, there's relief in sight through the application of money. But urban and rural communities may be in a world of hurt increasingly, but in a patchwork as it hits. I will tell you, Northern California communities last year, Willits and some other places, Montague went up there with the drought task force. We had to run pipe and drill wells and do all kinds of things because those communities were within 30 days of running out of water. The rain in December like dumped right on them, and they're overflowing. No problem there right now. The San Joaquin area got less, and New Melones and some of those reservoirs are down to 11%, and we're having to make some terrible, tough decisions in slashing fish flows and other things just so that there's enough water for people up there.
This question is, what is the range of amount of snowfall considered for future planning purposes, and what are the contingencies for allocation of water over the time, over the range?
That's an interesting question. I mean, there are estimates of snowfall, but again, you don't know. This is a known unknown. You can't predict it. You know what the historical range has been over the last 100 years. We just bust through that this season, and so now all bets are off. But if you go to the California Water Plan that DWR puts together, Department of Water Resources, they have those estimates. I just don't know what they are, the range. But again, we're in a new normal where nothing's normal. It never was that normal. That's what everybody always suspected about California. But now we're really not normal in our normal range of normal. But there are plans. They vary. Water is managed traditionally individual by local agencies. They all have. The urban areas all have drought contingency plans, the large urban areas. Small ones, not necessarily. Agriculture has to do these ag water management plans. If they're over 25,000 acres, the governor's executive order dropped that to 10. Folks have different plans. But essentially, again, particularly in rural California that tends to focus on their water rights, it's not like a pool that we allocate across everybody. It's a very harsh system, seniority rules, and juniors are cut off entirely in favor of their seniors, a very harsh system. Urban California is somewhat insulated from that because it came later, it's junior, and it's supplied by the projects and their own local groundwater. And so it's just a different kind of a system. And so every agency should have a plan for this. And as a state, we're looking right now, part of that slide about planning is we're now planning for year 5 and 6. And what will that mean in terms of what we need to help disadvantaged communities, in particular in rural California, because they're the ones that need all of our help.
What are the pros and cons of the two water tunnels proposed? In your opinion, must we build them, or are there other alternatives to consider?
Well, I'll go this far. I've already talked about it a little bit. I mean, I'll be making a judgment on it. Our board, in making a decision in a change of a water right permit, has to consider two things, and that is we have to assure that no other legal user of water is hurt and that fish and wildlife are not unduly impacted, and we can put conditions on our decisions to assure that. So there'll be big decisions to be made. It'll be in multiple days, many months of hearings, all evidentiary, adjudicatory, transparent. Every lawyer, not just in California, every water rights lawyer in the Western Hemisphere will probably be here. And it'll be very transparent, and we'll see what happens. I think in general, from an engineering standpoint, doing some sort of alternative conveyance has always been the answer that the Fish and Wildlife folks and the engineers prefer, precisely because of that problem with having the pumps at the bottom. But there is a very real concern on the part of the environmental community that it'll just create a more efficient way to drain the delta and take water from Fish and Wildlife. And it's only my board's rules that would stop that. But my board we are political appointees. Once I'm appointed and confirmed, I can't be dismissed, but it's just a 4-year term. And so we could do a great job, and people have a lot of faith in my board, but we won't be here for 20 years. We might be here for the next 5 or 10 years collectively. And so there'll probably be all kinds of agreements that need to be there in order to assure Delta folks and environmental folks that the downsides that they fear won't happen. And I do not minimize how challenging that will be. But from a plumbing perspective, we've got just about the worst plumbing. That was the last place they should have put those pumps.
Why was California so slow to react to this long-lasting drought?
We were actually very rapid in responding to the drought compared to everywhere else we know of. In fact, in the early meetings where we pulled it together over a year ago, the governor asked, because again, it might have rained. It was January, right? It was January at year 3. And he said, well, is this early or is this late or what? Has any governor ever declared a drought this early? And I was so proud of myself because I went into my bag and I said, yes, governor, you did. And you did it 2 weeks earlier last time. He was very proud of himself. So we actually did it rather early, and some of the reaction that you're getting to some of our actions is that people think it's going to rain next year, so why are we inconveniencing them? We are making a judgment that we now know we have to act as if it won't rain next year, and we know that if it rains this fall, everyone will be really mad at us. And they won't think, wow, how far-sighted. They decided to be safe rather than sorry. And I have told local agencies, and we did this 9 months ago, and we did the first set of regs, just be mad at me. Just tell them to be mad at me. I'm not running for anything. I'm not in your just do it and blame me. We just have to do it. It's the leadership move. And so we actually did act early. And the Water Action Plan that I didn't spend a lot of time on and could have done my whole talk on really was our administration over a year ago laying out our priorities for the next 5 years to say, enough of this talk that goes on forever in water. Let's do. So what's the Yoda line? There is no try, only do. Let's do it, and let's do all of it, because we have to do all of it. So it's a very rapid response.
These are two similar questions in a way. They have to do with economics and what's happening in terms of our delivery process. Why are water bottling companies allowed to pump billions of gallons of California water to sell around the U.S.? And similar to that, I'm going to put these two together.
Okay.
Farmers are still planting almond seedings, mm-hmm. although almond trees need lots of water year-round. Why does the state allow this?
It really interesting question, and one of the ones that comes up quite a bit, and I'll answer it in a couple of ways. One is, we don't have a planned state or a planned economy like the Chinese do and others. We don't tell people how to make money. We don't tell them what to manufacture. We don't tell them what to grow. I'm not sure you want government telling people what to make or what to grow. What we do have is a system where if you have a legal entitlement to water, you can use it, both for personal health safety and life and life-affirming things and for municipal and other benefits and for economic commerce. Economic commerce is a very big part of water's value in our society. So it's hard to make a choice about what people do with that. I'll get to there's a caveat here that is important. But if you look at bottled water, there are reasons why people don't like bottled water. I mean, anything anybody doesn't like has come out as something to point the finger at, whether it's fracking, which actually doesn't use that much water here compared to the West, really very small amount. And there are issues with fracking, quality issues, things, reason why we passed, actually, the most aggressive regulation on it in the country last year or the year before. But people have picked at whatever it is they don't like and said, why do you let them do that? And it's because that's what they do. How do you make a decision that bottled water shouldn't be made, but beer should be? Beer takes more water in the processing than bottled water does. How about Coke? Again, how about electronics manufacturing? Those all take water. And people just don't understand how much water. People, when it comes to agriculture, think about your daily life. Okay, an almond is a gallon per nut. That seems to offend people. It's very high value per drop in economic value, and we've been encouraging people to make better economic use of every drop of water. Walnuts take 5 gallons per walnut. If you like ice cream, that really takes a lot. Broccoli, that takes a lot too. Should we start saying we're not going to do almonds or broccoli, or you can't? Really, it's a slippery slope, an understandable question and reaction. But again, what's our economic system, and who do you want making those decisions? Farming is a calling. It's also a business, and people take risks, and they can go out of business, but they're following the market. Again, am I justifying any of that? Am I justifying golf courses? And yeah, I like bowling versus golf courses. I mean, but I'm not going to say you can't have a golf course. I'm just going to say use less water on that golf course if you want to use it. And you as a community decide where your greatest economic value may be and use your zoning or other powers. There is, however, an issue with trees, and I'll tell you what it is. It's not as if we're in one bucket of water that we all share. Again, it varies. The issue that you should watch for in the weeks and months to come, and that's coming to the fore, has to do with the proliferation of planting of trees over overdrafted groundwater basins. Why? Because we don't have groundwater management yet. The groundwater bill passed, but it has a fairly long time horizon to be realistic and to get it passed, but also to be realistic. But make no mistake, a big part of why folks in agricultural areas of California, maybe not at microphones, but in coffee shops and bars, would tell us, you guys have to set some state rules that make us do something, was because of the proliferation of plantings that were coming in largely from investors, but not exclusively from investors. Family farmers do almonds too because of the value. And the concern to watch for is where that planting creates a physical impact. Either neighbor versus neighbor, wells running dry, infrastructure collapsing, subsidence. And what you will see is more counties stepping up to deal with that in the zoning, because counties right now give the well drilling permits. Frequently they do it ministerially. They haven't thought about it. But the groundwater legislation gave them tools to deal with it, because part of what they said is we don't have the tools, and we gave them the tools. And so there's nothing that prohibits a county from stepping up and regulating that in a way where you're managing a community resource at a community level. So that physical impact of certain uses is going to be important. But picking one you like and one you don't of economic value can be a community conversation, but there's some peril in it.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program for our last question. And the question is, how can we require reduced consumption of water if we don't mandate for every water producing, every water producing that we do in the city, in our state, be attached to some water meter that will report how much consumption is being used?
No, that's a great issue, and it's one that I think is at the fore. I mean, where we focused a lot of our efforts in the water rights side of the House has been to use emergency powers the governor gave us to do emergency information orders. So we have much better information on use than we had last year when we did curtailments, and we're sort of doubling down on information so we can manage the system. I think ultimately in a world in which water shortages become more frequent, population growth, we want agriculture to stay resilient, we want our environment to be more resilient, we're going to have to meter and measure everything eventually. That has some cost, so you might want to do it over time, but we really are going to need to meter and measure it. Right now the law says that if you're a water rights holder, which tends to be agriculture, it's also urban, some urban communities, that you have to report to us either once a year or every 3 years. We're going to be requiring it through emergency orders more frequently, I'm pretty sure. But it says you only have to meter it if it's economically feasible, and that's not defined. I think that's going to need to get defined. And I think that just becomes important. That said, you know, the state law says that urban areas need to be metered by 2025. Again, frequently in legislation, you did this at the local level too, you make a decision. We did it at the federal level too. You make a decision on what the right answer is, and then you give time for implementation to deal with the economic and other impacts of it. Fresno's already done it. A lot of the Central Valley cities haven't. Sacramento was on a path to 2025, but doing a state-of-the-art smart meters with telemetry, really great stuff. They're about half done, and they just recently voted to change it and do it in half the time because they know they need it. That said, Sacramento is one of the real success stories because you measure it based on water production, which, you know, the institution, the agency knows how much they're delivering out to customers, or at least sending out to customers. What they don't have is the benefit of meters, but what they did because of that is they did the most aggressive outdoor irrigation rules, and they put water cops on the beat, and they are visible and out there, and they were achieving 20% and more. They were my stars in outdoor mandatory conservation because they knew they needed to. So you can do it. It's just if you have meters, it's better.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the State of California's Water, Now and in the Future. With Felicia Marcus, Chair of the California State Water Resources Control Board. Thank you so much, Felicia, for joining us tonight. We really appreciate your coming. And thank you to our audience here and our audiences on the radio and the Internet. Remember, you can find our programs at www.commonwealthclub.org, and you can access and download programs by clicking on the multimedia section on our website. Join us for our Environment and Natural Resources programs in June. They are listed on your green sheet, and I hope you will join us. June 4th, I never knew there were so many stars in the sky for our young people who are going to the camp, to a camp and look at what's going on in our state and national forests and our mountains and rivers. This will be a really great program, and I think you'll enjoy it. And on June 17th, Dr. Leslie Wong, president of San Francisco State University, will discuss the worldwide challenges and the environment, the dialogues that must take place. And also, San Francisco State University will host the yearly statewide Environmental California Higher Education Sustainability Conference. It's a long title. Here, right here in San Francisco, from July 20th to 24th. It is a great conference and open to everyone. For more information, contact San Francisco State University. Again, our thanks and appreciation to Felicia. Let's give her a great hand. I've known Felicia for a long time, and I really respect her, and I think she has... I'm saying this without having telling her that I was going to say this, one of the toughest jobs for all of the problems and the future we face and all of that. So I'm very grateful for her coming and the work that she does. Again, this is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 112 years of enlightened
Where'd it go?
Enlightened discussion. We are actually looking for the gavel at this point. In the know is adjourned.